generally gives you these kinds of U1, global U1s, and but do you mean in terms of the selection of the vacua?
Well, there it's used more to kind of select the cosmological constant.
Right, that's right.
Whereas here we are selecting something which is like dark matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so actually, generally, there are going to be many different domains of this VEV. So if the symmetry is broken below the scale of inflation, you're generally going to have an average over all of the different vacuum initial conditions. So this is actually somewhat predicted in that scenario. It's true that otherwise, inflation sort of picks a place for you if the symmetry is broken before inflation. So then maybe you can make some kind of argument that there's internal inflation, you're kind of sampling all kinds of different alignments. But yeah. I don't know if that answers your question, but it's sort of,
it was a vague question.
Sort of vague answer. So, okay, so last time we considered this very unusual and very non-thermal way of producing dark matter, which was basically dark matter from vacuumous alignment, where there's essentially some dynamics of the fields. So instead of talking about the particles, which are quantum excitations of the fields, you can actually talk about the fields themselves having some kind of energy. And what we'll show today is that this energy can actually explain dark matter. Okay, so to set the stage, last time we considered a theory that had a global U1 symmetry, and we had some scalar field that was charged under the symmetry, so that if I do some symmetry transformation, the field rotates, it picks up a phase. Okay. And so I can consider arbitrary potentials with this, but one possible potential is the Mexican hat potential, which is something that spontaneously breaks the symmetry. Okay. So basically, whether you have this or you have just a normal quadratic potential or quartic potential depends on sort of the sign of the mass term. So here, basically, the mass term turns out to be negative. Okay. We know, for instance, from the Higgs mechanism that when you have something like this, the vacuum of the theory is not at phi equals zero, which has some finite value for the potential, but it's actually at phi equal to some non-zero value. And if we decompose the field in this way, what we see is that one component of the scalar field picks up a mass that's proportional to its vacuum excitation value, F, and one of the scalars stays massless. And we can just understand that from the fact that in the sort of bottom of this Mexican hat potential, there's a circle that corresponds to the U1 symmetry. And rotations of, under the U1 correspond to a shift of this field, which is called the Goldstone field. And so all of these things are at the same energy. So it doesn't take any energy to move the field around. Okay? So this corresponds to some massless direction. And similarly, just the potential associated with this field is just zero. Okay? If it has no kinetic energy, then there's no energy stored in this field. But practically speaking, we have to pick a vacuum and expand around it. And so the universe evolves into some value where A is, you know, sitting somewhere in the bottom of this potential. And it can be anywhere in this potential because they're all related by a symmetry transformation. So if I pick some particular point, I can just rotate my coordinate system. So morally speaking, A can be sitting anywhere. And we showed that this leads to a cosmology that's not that interesting. This heavy field just decays into the thermal bath, and so you don't end up with any sort of stable particles. And this corresponds to just some extra component of radiation that's not really constrained by anything. So what we want to see is what happens if we perturb this condition. So here we assume that the symmetry is exactly conserved. All of this is true. So, however, if the symmetry is explicitly broken, then this isn't true anymore. And in particular, we're going to assume that it's only broken for some time t greater than t0. And you'll just have to accept now that this is possible, and then after we're done our analysis, we'll go back and see what kinds of physical situations give rise to symmetry breaking that only seems to turn on. But this is important because what happens when before t0, so for t less than t0, this potential is flat, and so your Goldstone can basically be sitting anywhere in your potential. However, Once your symmetry is explicitly broken, what that's telling you is that all of the points on this circle are not exactly the same. There's something that distinguishes them. In particular, they can have different energy. So whereas before, maybe I'll draw it up here so it's less confusing. So when the symmetry is unbroken, I have my V of A, and it's just zero. Okay. Now, I no longer have some symmetry that relates different points of A, so in general, the energies are going to be different, so I'm going to end up with some slight difference. So there's still going to be some lowest point, but instead of it being all the possible values of A, there's going to be some value here that's the lowest point of my potential. So let's say that my back in this stage, where I can sort of find myself anywhere on this line, I find myself, say, at this point. So this is actually where my physical vacuum is sitting for the field. And we know that everywhere in space should have the same value for this vacuum, because if you have different values of the field in different places, this corresponds to some energy in the derivative of this field. Okay. So now, once this potential turns on, if I'm still sitting in the same place, I see, oh, I was sitting in the vacuum, but now I'm not sitting in the vacuum anymore. There's actually some finite energy associated with it. Okay, and just like any other system where we have some degree of freedom and we have a potential, this potential generates a force. And so the field, which is sitting here in this high energy state, doesn't want to sit in that high energy state anymore. It wants to roll down into the vacuum. Okay, so what we'll show is that basically the dynamics of the field A with potential V of A are basically the same as just a normal particle in a classical potential. In other words, there's some force which corresponds to, you know, the gradient of the potential, something like this. No, I shouldn't say that. It's kind of confusing. Okay, so this is good because this just reproduces a problem from classical mechanics. And so if I'm, just for the sake of making the equation simple, if I'm close enough to the minimum, then I can approximate this by doing a Taylor expansion. Okay, so this is generally some arbitrary function. This function has to be periodic in A over F, because I know if A over F changes by a factor of 2 pi, I come back on my original thing. So this is generally some kind of a sine or a cosine function. But I can basically always do a Taylor expansion. So there's going to be some coefficient here. My energy is going to be smallest at the minimum, and then there's some coefficient here. Okay? And this corresponds to the mass of A. Remember that in any potential for a field theory, the mass is the coefficient of the quadratic term. Okay? And basically, this is just saying that before, the reason why A was massless was because we had this shift symmetry that made it so it didn't get a mass. Now, however, the symmetry is explicitly broken, so you pick up a small mass. And in the tutorial today, you'll actually show, if you have some model where you explicitly break the symmetry, that A picks up a mass. Okay, so now I just do my normal thing, which is, you know, MA is equal to the derivative of the potential. So I got something that's like mass times acceleration. It's the equivalent of Newton's second law. I got this. So the evolution of the scalar field is driven by the gradient of this potential. So for simplicity, we'll just define A min is equal to zero. This is just some shift of our coordinate system. And so what we end up with is A of t is equal to A zero cos ma t. Yes, Tibor. That's right. So there is an effective friction, but remember all of the A interactions are like 1 over F d mu A psi bar gamma mu psi. So if we're at energies much smaller than F, then these things are essentially negligible. they don't provide any important friction. Okay, so really what's going on here is just that we thought we were sitting at the minimum potential. Some dynamics turns on and we see, oh no, there's actually some potential here and we're not at the lowest energy state, we're in some excited state. And that energy is stored in the field and it manifests itself as some oscillation of this field. Okay, and it's a uniform oscillation in space. It's spatially homogeneous and it's coherent. The entire field is oscillating at the same time. Okay. And so I can ask, well, what's the energy of this field? Okay, well, once again, this is just like the harmonic oscillator. The energy density is just going to be the time average of the potential. So I can plug this into my potential and then do a time average. The cos squared gives me a factor of a half. And this gives me 1/2 ma squared a naught squared. So this energy density is just there if this situation happens. Okay. So I think this is not the confusing part. The confusing part is convincing yourself that this is a physical situation that can actually happen, which we'll talk about later. But if you accept that this is a plausible series of events, then you end up with this kind of dynamics. It just follows from classical mechanics. There isn't really any trickery involved. Okay. So now we can ask, well, what is a typical value of this A0, right? So if this is sort of, I take this flat potential to mean that I'm equally likely to sit anywhere, I could imagine some kind of uniform distribution. Yes,
so why are we
So you're right. It's okay. So there's no factor of a half here. So it's basically V plus the kinetic energy. But either way, it's the same energy that's stored in the field. Okay. Now, in what we've been doing, so for instance, there are more than a factor of two affected by the fact that this potential is not exactly quadratic. So when I compute the oscillation, I have to consider, say, the fact that it's an anharmonic potential. But up to order one factor, this is the relationship that we get. Okay. Okay, so we want to actually estimate what this energy density is. Okay, so this is sort of step one, because we want to see, could it be the energy density associated with dark matter? And two, we want to check that it has the qualitative features of dark matter, namely that it's cold matter. Okay, because cold matter is exactly what we need in order to have right structure formation. And from the perspective of, say, GR, cold matter really refers to an energy momentum tensor that has some energy density and zero pressure, okay, because it's not moving. That's sort of what our definition of matter is. And we showed that this is equivalent to So the matter energy density scales with the Hubble expansion as 1 over a cubed. Okay, so all of these statements are equivalent to one another. So as long as we can show one of those things, then we're okay. So to answer the first question of what is rho a, we need to know what ma is and we need to know what a0 is. So I'm just going to take this as an input for my theory. It's in general something that is specified by the explicit breaking of your symmetry. Okay? So what we really want to know is what's this initial value of the displacement. And this can, if I sort of treat the fact that this is a flat potential as an invitation to assume that I have some kind of uniform probability of ending up anywhere here, which is sort of what you would assume given the symmetry anyway, I use the fact that this field was defined as essentially a phase. Okay, so if A over F goes to A over F plus 2 pi, it's actually the same thing. Okay. So basically what this is telling me is that physically A sort of sits somewhere between 0 and 2 pi times f. Or alternatively, it's some order 1 number times f. Okay. So if I'm just sort of happen to find myself sitting anywhere here, then my a0 is typically going to be some order 1 number times f. Again, I'm being a little bit sketchy just because there are enough other order one factors in this problem. What we really care about is just the scaling of what the energy is, okay? So that we can get some parametric estimates for these things. So really, my rho A is some order one factor times MA squared times F squared, where F is the scale of the spontaneous breaking. So this is sort of the mass of the heavy scalar. Now I want to address the second part, which is, okay, I have some energy density, but I haven't done anything to convince you that this is possibly dark matter. And the way that one can see that it's dark matter is I want to know what are the effects under the Hubble expansion. And so far, I've been ignoring the Hubble expansion with the assumption that all of these oscillating dynamics are sort of happening fast enough that I don't really care about the Hubble expansion. But that's, of course, restricted to a very specific point in time. Okay. So how do I include the effects of the Hubble expansion? Well, what I want are the classical field equations of motion in sort of an, you know, in the FRW background. And of course, how do we get field equations of motions? We take the action and we find the critical points of the action. Okay, we find where the action has zero variation. So the action is just going to be d4x root g times my Lagrangian density. So it's this here, this is where the Hubble expansion comes in. Okay, and then I do my usual thing where I take delta s by delta phi and I set it equal to 0. And this tells me what classically my field responds to terms in its Lagrangian. And what you end up finding is that with this potential, you end up with a double dot plus 3h a dot plus m a squared a is equal to 0. So you basically end up with almost exactly the same thing as we had for our differential equation here. Okay. This is just the ma squared a term. Yes?
So that was the field equation before, right? So suddenly we do contradictory field equations.
Right, so this is assuming that my time that I'm integrating over is small compared to Hubble, right? So, I mean, this is sort of hand-wavy, right? I was kind of like, oh, there's a vacuum and there's a potential, and classically I expect this, right? But I actually have to do, so this is just sort of an approximate equation.
So we can think of the equation on the right as the average value of an average value
in
short times.
This
is sort of the short time field
equation. Yeah, so this is the correct equation if basically if m squared is much bigger than Hubble, then this reduces to the old equation. So I don't think this is necessarily an average. This is just sort of taking different limits of how you're solving the equation. But this is the, okay, so we know that the, you know, at this point the universe has expanded a lot since whatever has been going on in the early universe. So we know that we need to take into account some factor of like the Hubble expansion. So I would say that this is the actual equation you want to solve, but this is sort of the heuristic equation. And what we'll see, well, basically if you take this equation and solve it, the only effect of this 3h is that it gives you this extra factor in the energy density. So you have okay, so you get the exact same solution for the energy density, which is sort of why people often derive it in this limit, because it's more complicated to solve the equation with Hubble sitting there. So you end up with the exact same dynamics of A, but then there's this also a scaling associated with this 3H. And it just comes from the fact that this factor of three is causing the field to expand along with the universe. Okay, so this is diluting all of the effects of the dynamics of the field. Okay, so I would argue that if you want an intuitive idea of what's going on without confusing yourself about what's happening in the universe expansion, so this is true in sort of a static limit. This is how you can derive the expression, but you can work through it in an exactly analogous way. And all that you end up with is this extra dynamics associated with the scale factor. Yes?
So would the oscillation be observable today?
Yeah, so that's actually some experiments try to. So it depends what this A couples to, but you can look for these kinds of operators. The fact that there's this d mu A coupling gives you an A dot, and you can look for the sort of A dot over A interaction with fermions. So that's a model dependent question. Yeah. I don't think so, because I think that you need to, right, so if the potential changes, then you disrupt this oscillation, you change your matter content. So I mean, maybe there's some way that you could cook up sort of a few fields that kind of couple together in some weird way, but you probably don't want to mess up the dark matter too much. But I haven't really thought about that in any detail. So I'm not going to solve this equation explicitly, but you can check that this is in fact a solution. Like the A basically is A cosine times this scale. Okay, I realize this is bad notation, so let's just temporarily call the scale factor R. Okay, but so A is the Goldstone field, and R is a scale factor. Okay. So what this tells us is that rho goes like r to the minus 3, which is exactly what we get from matter. Okay, so it's this weird thing where this coherent oscillation of the scalar field gives you an energy momentum tensor that looks exactly like matter. It looks like cold non-relativistic matter. So this is exactly what we expect from dark matter. So this shouldn't really be thought of as, you know, individual dark matter particles, but these excitations of the field are sort of some coherent ensemble of very cold scalars that are sitting there. Yes.
If you think of this as dark matter, mm-hmm. As a field, you know, does this explain the galactic halo?
Yes. So in principle, then you have to compute what's the gravitational evolution of these things. So what you have to do is, so the way that halos form is that there's some perturbation of the gravitational potential, and then things fall in. And all that requires is basically an understanding of that it's some matter that is not relativistic. Okay. Otherwise, if it were relativistic, it would stream out and destroy the structure that you have. So in some sense, this is sort of ideal clumping dark matter, but you have to follow the evolution of gravitational perturbations, which we're not going to do. I'm just arguing that in terms of cosmological abundance, this can explain dark matter. And there's some active debate about exactly what the effect of this like coherent oscillation is on structure formation. So some people think that it allows the formation of these things called caustics, which are like these excitations in the angular momentum structure of the dark matter halo. And so I wouldn't say that it's completely settled, but you can get the gross features of dark matter from this picture. Okay, so people have studied this in detail now for 20 or 30 years, but the idea is that it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck. It satisfies all of our criteria for dark matter, even though it does not look like what we've been talking about for particle dark matter. And part of, I think, why it's important to show this is exactly that dark matter can be something that's really weird. It's not necessarily just a particle that looks exactly like what we know. It can be this oscillation of a scalar field. Okay, and this is very non-thermal because the temperature of this is essentially zero. Okay, there's no kinetic energy associated with spatial gradients in this. It's just like I said, it scales like R cubed. Okay, so the energy is dominantly inherent to the field, and that's exactly what we call mass. Right. And it's also, if I define an effect of NA, which is rho A over MA, this is much bigger than what I would naively expect for some equilibrium number density. Okay. So essentially, I have this very, very large amount of like cold collisionless matter. Okay. Now, you could worry, and you'd say, well, I have these huge number of particles at zero temperature, and so I need to make sure that thermal scatterings don't disrupt this. Because if I have this field come into thermal equilibrium, then there's a huge sort of entropic pressure to destroy this large number of these Goldstone fields and restore it to thermal equilibrium. So what you're really saved by is the fact that all of these things are suppressed by this 1 over F interaction. And so what you need to ensure is that the scales at which this is happening are sufficiently below F that you don't sort of mess up your picture. Okay. So you need the sort of temperature T naught to be much, much, much less than F. Okay. And you need the mass of the axion field to be much, much less than F. Because of course, if the mass is big and you have large explicit breaking, then you don't need to have this 1 over F suppression because you can just write down a direct coupling of A to everything else. Okay. So just as some for some numerics, let's say I take the temperature at this scale to be about a GeV, which we'll show is a reasonable choice in a while. And I take MA is equal to 10 microelectron volts. And I take F to be about 10 to the 11 GeV. Then my omega dark matter is about 0.25. Really, this is omega in this field A. So you can see from these parametrics that you need some very tiny breaking of the symmetry, and you need some enormous scale for your for what the VEV of the scalar field that's kind of driving the whole dynamics are. So this is, like I said, a very strange setup because you have sort of, this is the temperature of the thermal plasma, you have some very small MA, you have some enormous number of them, which gives you a sufficient dark matter density, and you have this sort of large separation of scales. Yes, Ryan.
How sensitive is this to those choices? Like, is there a reasonably large range of each parameter?
So you used to think that the answer was yes. So it scales like this, essentially. So, or I should say like this. So if I raise F and I lower MA, then it basically turns out to be the same. It turns out that there are restrictions on what this F can be from the recent bicep measurement, where if the symmetry is broken during the time of inflation, you have this massless mode during inflation, and this causes something called isocurvature perturbations that are excluded by the CMB. So it's actually just in the past few weeks that axion dark matter, the window has shrunk significantly to sort of around this range. Okay, so this is sort of weird, and it's the only way to really get an intuitive sense of this is to kind of work through some of the calculations yourself. But the point is that dark matter doesn't actually have to look like just sort of particles floating around. Yes, Kira.
Isn't the scamp inflation more like 10 to
16?
Lower.
Right. So the problem is that if an inflation happens first and then you break the symmetry, then so what we used to think was, well, this rho A is some order one factor times F squared. But if I tune my initial conditions so that I'm actually sitting right here, then this coefficient in front of the F can be anything I want it to be. And so what people said was, well, if inflation happens first, I sort of land at one particular point here for my entire universe, and then that drives my dynamics, and I can just sort of say, okay, well, inflation tuned my initial conditions, and so then I can change F and MA to be whatever I want to be. It turns out that bicep says that this symmetry breaking has to happen after inflation, which actually means there are several causally disconnected patches. So if you want to be really proper, you have sort of some section of the universe that's sitting here and some section of the universe that's happening here. And so what you're really doing is some kind of ensemble average over all of your different initial conditions. And then that really forces you to be sitting in an order one coefficient here. Okay? And so then that nails down, if your f is too much bigger than this, then, okay, well, so a lot of theories actually have some, you know, there's some theory calculation, and you get a 1 over f suppression of the mass. So for instance, people often talk about the QCD axiom, which I'll mention briefly, but these aren't independent parameters for that. So then you really can't move the parameters any higher, because if you push f too much, then you overproduce dark matter. Okay, so this whole scenario hinged on the fact that we were able to construct this setup where the symmetry breaking, explicit symmetry breaking, sort of turned on at some particular time. Okay, if the symmetry breaking were present in the very early universe, then I would just initially go to the minimum, and I wouldn't have any energy in this vacuum. Okay, so this is sort of the most important question. How does symmetry breaking turn on? And it turns out there are two possible answers to this. So one is that there is actual explicit breaking in the potential, but it's small. So for instance, if instead of having my normal potential, so I have V of phi is lambda over 2, f squared, phi squared minus f squared over 2 squared, and then I just turn on something that looks like this. Okay, so notice this is phi squared and not absolute value of phi squared. This term here, under the symmetry transformation, goes like e to the 2i alpha phi squared, which is not invariant. Okay, so this is a possible way that you can explicitly break the symmetry. It just was never in my theory to begin with. So then the question of why didn't I just land in the vacuum in the first place becomes very important. And the answer to this question can come from our full equation for the scalar field evolution, including the Hubble scale. Okay, so this oscillation assumed that ma squared, which is basically related to this parameter mu squared, is much, much bigger than Hubble. But if it's the other way around, if this ma squared is much, much less than Hubble, then you don't get oscillation yet. Okay? Just that term is negligible in the equation, and you just end up with a being a constant. So what this means is that the turn on of the oscillation happens at MA is equal to the Hubble scale. And you'll show in tutorial that this typically implies that, say, mu over f has to be separated by some 25 orders of magnitude. Okay, so you can have this picture work by just having some very, very tiny explicit symmetry breaking. And because the expansion of the universe is so fast initially, you're just not sensitive to it. And then at a certain point, it suddenly kicks in and you start oscillating. But you have to believe that your potential is very tuned. You have to believe that your potential is almost exactly symmetric. And then I turn on this very, very tiny symmetry breaking. Okay, so this is a technically, it's a consistent framework. However, we know that generally quantum corrections will change the tree level values of these parameters. So you really need to believe that, you know, your theory looks like this in order for this to be a consistent way out. But this is a possibility. Okay? So it's worth mentioning. The second way, which is more common, is through the chiral anomaly. Okay? So what this is, we learned in quantum field theory is that U1 symmetries can be classically conserved but broken by quantum effects. Okay. So in particular, if I have a chiral symmetry, a chiral symmetry is a symmetry that by definition acts differently on the left and right-handed components of the fermions. So for instance, I have psi left goes to e to the I theta left, psi left. Psi right goes to e to the I theta, psi right. My classical Lagrangian might be invariant. But in quantum field theory, what we care about is the path integral, where we're integrating over all field configurations. And it turns out that even if this is invariant, this is not invariant under such a symmetry. Okay. And so symmetries that look fine can actually be broken. And the effect of the anomaly is to shift your classical Lagrangian to the classical Lagrangian plus alpha of some gauge interaction times the difference between the left and right-handed phases times the trace of the gauge field strength. Okay, so this is something that hopefully you saw in an earlier class. Okay. Now the technical details won't concern us too much, but the important thing is that we've been talking about scalar fields, but if there happen to be any fermions that are charged under this symmetry, and the symmetry acts in a way differently on left and right-handed fermions, then the symmetry is automatically broken by quantum mechanical effects. Okay. Oh, sorry, this is tilde. So this is the dual field strength. G. Sorry, it's the sort of Fs and Gs everywhere, so sort of keep track of it. Okay, so if the shift symmetry is broken, so if this U1 symmetry is broken, then the corresponding Goldstone acquires a mass. So we want to know how does the anomaly correspond to a mass for the Goldstone? So one way of seeing it is that U1 transformations of these fields, so basically changes in these phases, show up as this coefficient in front of the field strengths. And we know that shifts of the U1 symmetry exactly change. These are broken. So shifts of the U1 symmetry change A to A plus alpha, essentially. Okay. So if I do these anomalous rotations, this tends to show up in front of this field strength. This is also equivalent to shifting of A. So I can write down an effective Lagrangian that's basically A over 4 pi times alpha g trace. And this is something that you'll sort of show explicitly in the tutorial. There's actually a very simple argument about why this is the case, but it kind of makes intuitive sense that performing a U1 transformation results in this coefficient showing up here. This is, of course, the same as just changing A to theta left minus theta r. And so you end up with a coefficient that shows up here. So this explicitly breaks the shift symmetry. And so we expect that this effective interaction will generate a mass for A. OK, so this was kind of a lot just in one time. So are there any questions about what we've been doing so far? Okay, so we want to know what the, you know, what's the physical effect? And naively, you'd think, okay, well, I have this new interaction, which is between A and something else, and so I can construct loops of that, and it will give me, you know, an A squared mass term. But it's not quite that easy. And the reason is that you can show that trace of G mu nu is basically a derivative of this thing. Okay, so this term here is actually a total derivative. And I know that when I integrate something that's a total derivative, this is just basically, you know, k evaluated on the boundary. And usually this is just zero because all of my fields fall off as I go to the boundary. And so I evaluate this thing, which is a total derivative. So it seems like this doesn't actually contribute anything. Okay. But I think that in the PSN class you showed this, but this turns out not to actually be true. The reason is basically that the gauge fields don't actually fall off fast enough. Okay? So this integral can actually be something finite. And this integral, alpha g over 4 pi, is actually some topological invariant integer, which is called the Chern-Simons number. Karen?
So in this case, we've learned the effect of Lagrangian. We have an A in the front, which is not necessarily a constant. So
Yes, so one way that you can see this is that, so this is generally true, but what we care about in this situation are the homogeneous solutions for A, which so are independent of X and they only depend on time.
Even then, that's
not true. That's true, but you can, so you can define some equivalent Chern sort of similar number where you, instead of having a D4X, you separate out the time component and the spatial component. But that's a good question. So this argument is a little bit heuristic, okay? But what I'm trying to argue is that generally this thing doesn't have any effect up to these sort of non-perturbative things, okay? And this will continue to be true in the axion case as well. But that's a good question. It's a little bit of a flaw, but sort of in the interest of not getting into too many technical details, it's something that we have to just take. Okay, so the story is that we have this coupling to something. It seems like a total derivative, and so it probably doesn't contribute up to the fact that there's some Chern-Simons number. What this corresponds to is the fact that the gauge field can, so there's some mapping of the spatial dimensions to the gauge direction. So if I have some SU2 symmetry, that's equivalent to a sphere. And so essentially my gauge field can sort of wrap around my spatial directions, okay? And these things can be equivalent because you can perform a gauge transformation and show that they're the same, but local perturbations don't actually change them. Yes, Tibbert.
At some point, you switch from U1 to
U2. So this is the gauge field, which is not the U1. This is something that it's that the fermion is charged under. Okay. So what's confusing about the anomaly is that gauge interactions of this fermion psi break the anomaly that are not the gauge interactions associated with the U1 symmetry. Okay. Okay, so you can ask, well, okay, so I have these gauge field configurations which correspond to this trace. So what's the contribution to my effective A potential? And it turns out that you can show that the action satisfies something called a Bogomolny bound. I'm not sure how to exactly pronounce it. So the action associated with the anomaly, with basically changing this winding number, which is the only effect that the anomaly has on anything physical, is given by something that's inversely proportional to the gauge coupling. And this is something that hopefully you derived in your class where you talked about non-perturbative physics a lot, but you can basically prove this by an argument that I want g mu nu plus g tilde mu nu squared to be positive, and I can relate the sort of g mu nu part of the action to the g mu nu, g tilde mu nu action, and I pick up some factor of 1 over g squared from this coefficient. Okay, so the point is that for a perturbative theory, all of my rates, which go like the path integral, which in Euclidean time goes like e to the minus action, this is exponentially goes like 8 pi squared n over the gauge coupling squared. So if I have a perturbative theory where my coupling is very, very small, then this has no effect whatsoever. So in a perturbative theory, I have these non-perturbative corrections that arise from the fact that my gauge field has these sort of non-trivial configurations on my space, and that this can break my symmetry. But it doesn't actually matter, because if I compute the rate of these things happening, it's 0. Okay. So what this means is that that when g is small, then MA is 0. So basically my U1 symmetry is exactly preserved. Okay. Now, if I have an asymptotically free gauge theory, what asymptotic freedom tells me is that here's my gauge coupling, here's my energy, is that it flows to 0 at high energies. The flip side of this is that it blows up at some scale, which we usually call lambda associated with the gauge theory. So what happens is I have small gauge coupling, so in all of this region, the U1 global is exact. There's some anomaly, but the effects are not important. And then all of a sudden, my gauge coupling goes to infinity formally. And I end up with, OK, suddenly this is not looking so small. Suddenly I'm violating my symmetry with a very large rate. So it's right in this region that the U1 global is violated. And this corresponds to a turning on of the axion mass. Okay, so there's actually some dynamics that are breaking the symmetry. And it comes from the fact that the origin of the symmetry breaking is non-perturbative, so it's only when I'm in a non-perturbative regime that any of this stuff matters. That's sort of the like zeroth order punchline, if you don't sort of remember all of the details of instantons and all of this kind of thing. Just basically speaking, there's sort of a point at which this suddenly becomes relevant. Okay? And this point is typically right at the scale of confinement associated with whatever this asymptotically free gauge theory is. Okay, so the basic picture is that I have an anomaly. And this leads to a very interesting structure, which is that MA equals 0 for T is bigger than whatever the like confinement scale of that gauge symmetry is. The mass is not 0 for T comparable to this confining scale. And then this gives me some dark matter abundance, quite generically. So as long as I have an anomalous symmetry that's coupled to, you know, that there's some chiral fermions that are charged under this symmetry that interact with the gauge field, when this gauge field blows up, I'm going to generate a dark matter abundance. Okay, so this was sort of a lot, and I think that this is sort of the key thing that you want to keep in mind, that in spite of the fact that there seem to be a lot of technical details here, what the point remains that most of the particles we know about in nature are chiral. In the standard model, left-handed and right-handed fermions don't come in pairs. They come charged differently. So we generically expect that if there's a global symmetry, that there are going to be chiral fermions charged under it. This is generically going to lead to anomalies. And really, the only well-defined gauge theories we have are asymptotically free gauge theories. So when people talk about the vacuumless alignment mechanism being generic, what they mean is that these are ingredients that you just expect to pop out of high energy theories. Okay? And then if the parameters happen to align such that you end up with, you know, this, then the oscillation of this field can explain dark matter. Okay? And you don't need to add any new particle dynamics in the perspective of I don't have to add some neutral fermion, and et cetera. So in that sense, it's a much more complicated story than, say, thermal freeze out, WIMP dark matter. But it's something that if you're trying to look at UV completions of the standard model, you just typically end up with this stuff happening. Okay, Tibra.
So is there any known global symmetry which can be used?
And any known global symmetry? That's a good question. So you need a global symmetry that's spontaneously broken. And so there are some global symmetries in the standard model. So for instance, baryon and lepton number, which are anomalous. And we'll talk more about next time about what the implications of that are. But we probably don't want them to be spontaneously broken too low, because otherwise that might lead to things like proton decay, et cetera. So I think there are ways to make it work, but not just in the sort of very vanilla standard model. Okay. But in the last few minutes, I will explain a theory that does have these features. Yes. So yes, it can be a QCD axion, but I think the symmetry that's broken is not exactly the chiral symmetry. So I mean, you have to add some new scalar field that's breaking additional symmetry. Okay. So, but that's exactly the particular case I want to talk about. So this is what's called the QCD axion, and it's basically a new scalar field. It's charged under some new U1 symmetry, which is called the Petrie-Quinn symmetry, because it was originally invented by Petrie and Quinn. And this is a chiral symmetry for the QCD quarks. And it's a spontaneously broken symmetry. Okay, so one way that you can motivate this from the considerations we've already had is that we've seen that we need an asymptotically free gauge theory for this to work without tuning, say. And then we can say, well, I know of an asymptotically free gauge theory. That's just the SU3 QCD force. And we know that the scale at which QCD gets big is about a few hundred MeV, which sort of supports my judicious choice of the oscillation time being GeV. But if the scale is too much higher than that, then the oscillation gets damped by this scale factor cubed by too much. So you need the oscillation to happen somewhat late in order to get enough dark matter. Okay, so basically, if we follow through the exact same arguments, then you find that that the rolling turns on at lambda QCD. And so basically, this kind of interaction comes from couplings that are like phi quark left, quark right. Okay, where this has some transformation, and then say the quark left has an opposite transformation, and this doesn't transform. Now you can see an immediate problem with this, which is that if I replace phi by its VeV, then This gives me some mass F here. So this seems to give my quarks a mass that's like 10 to the 11 GeV or something. So when I say quarks, I really mean, you know, some extra quarks. But they become heavy and decouple from my theory. Okay? And it turns out that in the case of QCD, you can actually explicitly calculate what this mass of the axion is. So we argued here that the mass of the axion comes from these horrible non-perturbative dynamics. Okay? And all I was able to do here was say, either the rate is very small or very big, but I wasn't able to say anything other than that. I was just kind of waving my hands. But in QCD, we actually have a good handle on the non-perturbative physics because there are these things called protons and neutrons and pions, which are non-perturbative states of QCD, that I can go and measure their properties. Okay? And it's a calculation, which is an interesting calculation to do, but in the interest of time, I won't show it. You can basically show that the mass of the axion is related to the mass of the pion times something called f pi, which is basically controls the decay rate of the pion, divided by f. So in QCD, I can actually just compute what this is, because I have some experimental input, right? I can measure m pi, I can measure its decay rate, and therefore, so this is the pion decay constant. So this isn't something that we have it for just a generic BSM theory. So what's nice about the QCD axion is that it's actually, you know, there's some relations between these various parameters. And so you exactly get the ma is equal to 10 micro EV, f equals 10 to the 11 GeV solution. Okay, so this thing, if it's coupled to some kind of, you know, heavy quarks, can actually explain the dark matter distribution. Yes.
So it seems like from this that the calculation for rho would have no free parameters. It would just basically be.
It has one free parameter, it's the mass of the axe. Well,
mass of
oh, you're saying that once you impose dark matter? Mm-hmm.
The
X cancel. That's right.
So it only depends on M pi and F pi, which I assume have measurements of rho.
Yes.
So does it agree with
it? Well, so it has a free parameter in that you can control this initial displacement. But you're right that you would. Yeah, that's right. That's right. But you're right that. So, wait, sorry, the f's don't cancel, right? Because ma goes, yeah, hold on. Yeah, that's a good question. So there generally is one free parameter, and I'm not seeing right now how that actually shows up, because it does seem like it's a completely predictive thing. So I'll get back to you on that, okay? But just because we're out of time, I wanted to make one point about the QCD axion, which is that it actually solves a problem that's outstanding in QCD, okay? So in QCD, we basically want to write down all gauge invariant terms in our Lagrangian. And there's usually a term that we neglect. Okay? So our Lagrangian has the normal QCD term, and it also has this term that's called the theta term, which just basically comes from me writing down trace G, G dual. Okay. This is perfectly allowed by the gauge symmetries, but you know, so this has the normal kinetic terms, the gauge field strength, etc. But you know, we've already seen that terms like this are popping up, and in fact, we see that you know, for t lower than lambda QCD, this can actually have some physical effect associated with it. And so, through the same calculations that you can do to calculate the axion mass, you can show that this leads to something called a neutron electric dipole moment. Okay, so this term actually violates a symmetry that's called CP symmetry, And you can see that because it has an epsilon tensor in it. It has an epsilon mu nu rho sigma f rho sigma. And this flips sign when you invert one of the spatial indices. Okay? So this gives rise to weird effects. So for instance, the neutron, even though it's a neutral particle, it can kind of have some region of positive charge sort of on one end. This is sort of a heuristic argument. But the neutron is some bound state. It has some size associated with it. And even though it's neutral, the charges inside of the neutron can separate a little bit. Okay? And this is a CP violating process, because if I flip my parity, or I flip time equivalently, I end up with an opposite electric dipole moment. Okay? And so this gives you something that you can actually go and look for. I can take neutrons, I can apply an electric field, I can see if they polarize. And I don't see a neutron EDM. And so this leads to a constraint on theta that it's less than about 10 to the minus 11. So this is a little bit weird, because I have this parameter in my Lagrangian. It's allowed by all of the gauge symmetries, and it's small. And it can take any value between 0 and 2 pi, so why is it 10 to the minus 11? And it turns out that you can actually connect these two stories such that this GG dual, it both generates a neutron EDM, supposedly. It can generate a neutron EDM. But it also generates a potential for A, the axion, which is this Goldstone field. And it turns out that the potential that you get actually looks something like cosine of A over F minus theta. So my potential is actually minimized when the VEV of the axion field exactly cancels this value of theta. And so in my low energy theory, this theta gets driven to zero. Essentially, even if this parameter is in my theory, the axion at low energies picks up a VEV that exactly cancels it. And so with the axion, you don't end up with an EDM. And so this is some sort of dynamically enforced parameter. Okay? So this is why people like axions, because they say, OK, well, the strong CP problem is an outstanding problem. I have this particle physics solution to this, and it can also generate dark matter through the vacuum misalignment mechanism. Okay. But there are other kinds. So these Goldstones are generically called axions just by historical connection with these ones. But the actual production mechanism for dark matter, in a way, doesn't have anything to do with whether it's a QCD axion or some other axion. Okay, so we're out of time. So let me know if you have any questions. Yes, Kira. So the problem with the Higgs is that the Goldstone might actually get eaten in the Higgs mechanism. Okay? So remember, in the Higgs mechanism, you're trying to give a mass to a gauge boson. And a massless gauge boson has 2 degrees of freedom, and a massive gauge boson has 3. So that extra degree of freedom has to come from somewhere. And that's secretly the Goldstone boson of the associated field. So I can move to something called a unitary gauge. I don't know if they covered unitary gauge. But the idea of unitary gauge is that I have a massive gauge boson and no Goldstone. Okay. So if that's the case, then I just don't have any potential associated with it. Another way of thinking about it is that if this is a gauge symmetry, then if that symmetry is anomalous, then I'm explicitly breaking the gauge symmetry. Okay? But a gauge symmetry isn't really a symmetry. A gauge symmetry is just a redundancy in the way I'm describing my field theory. And so any anomalous gauge theory is actually just an inconsistent theory. Okay? So there are a few reasons why this can't be a gauge symmetry. Now, there are some problems associated with global symmetries, namely that you don't expect quantum gravity to preserve global symmetries. There's these no-hair theorems for black hole. And basically, you can show that black holes can only carry conserved gauge charges and not conserved global charges. So there are ways to try to get around this by having some sort of weakly gauge things. You take various limits, et cetera. But generally, it has to be a global symmetry. OK, thanks. So there's a tutorial today at 2, I guess.